Hello, podcast fans. I'm Bradley Simpson. When I think about the stories that stayed with me, one that immediately comes to mind is Ratatouille. A talented rat who just wants to cook, and honestly, I was glued to my screen straight away. And now, I'm hooked on FX's The Bear on Disney+. I love everything about it. I love the styling, the tension, the drama. It's the best thing I've watched in ages. Only the greatest stories stay with you for a lifetime, and honestly, it's true. So, what will be your next great story on Disney+?
Copyright 2025 Disney and its related entities. 18 plus, subscription required.
Welcome to I Think You're Overthinking It, the podcast. This is episode number 1149. Just a couple of quick things right off the top, and then we'll get into the show. I'm going to be performing stand-up with my buddy Mike Furman. We're going to be at Soul Joel's in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, August 15 and 16 in the year 2025. And also the following week, we're going to be at Levity Live in Huntsville, Alabama. That's August 22nd and 23rd. More dates will be added soon at chrishardwick.com and also Chris Hardwick on the socials. And yes, that includes TikTok. Now featuring TikTok. Because it's 2025. Yeah. Anyway, this episode is my friend Anna Gasteyer, whom I adore. You know, obviously, I was a huge fan of her work. And then we met because she came on the podcast in the early days of the podcast. And she's literally just one of the most talented people in the business. An incredible improviser, amazing actress and sketch performer, and also just mind-blowing voice. Does Broadway, was in Wicked, and has an incredible Christmas show called Sugar and Booze, which is an album that you can stream on Spotify and the various music platforms, but also a live show that she does during the Christmas holidays. And I believe this year, December 15th, she's going to be at the Town Hall in New York City. That's December 15th. But before that, she has some dates August 8th in Westport, Connecticut at the Westport Country Playhouse. And then August 9th, Fire Island, New York, and Evening with Anna Gasteyer. All of these shows, which you should go see, have information and or tickets at annagasteyer.com. AnnaGasteyer. But I could have talked to Anna for 6, 7, 8 hours straight, because it always just feels like we've only been chatting for like 10 minutes and then like 90 minutes have gone by. She's so fun and funny, and I really hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed actually having the conversation. So here it is, episode number 1149. I Think You're Overthinking It, with Anna Gasteyer. Roll the thing. That I was always I never did video for the podcast before, because I feel like it just creates a dynamic.
Yes.
Where it's a little more performance than
it's like being an interview.
Yeah, a little more performance than conversational, because when you see the lights and the cameras, I just do it now to get a couple of clips just to promote it, but I really feel like it was like being resistant to it for so long was a mistake, because all the ones that did.
Oh yeah, now it's
are like we're ahead of the curve, and now I sort of feel like, but still, it's I just feel like it's a lot to ask of someone to be like, come do my podcast that's kind of a TV show,
right?
And
for free. That's the other thing. Because everybody has a fucking podcast, so like, you know, and if you're a comedian, people want you to go on it, and
of course, I
always enjoy them, but like, it is kind of a friend of mine actually just said this. He was like, have we reached the point where people should be paying us an honorarium to show up on their podcast? And I was like, you know, there's not you, Chris, because you are the industry captain on this.
I did give you a soda.
You gave me a soda.
I got you a car service. Soda. There was a car service.
You introduced a lot of people to podcasting because Nerdist was so early in the game. But there were
podcasters before that. I was in an early wave, but like Marin was like 2009.
When were you?
2010.
Yeah.
I mean, my friend Jackie Cation started doing Dork Forest in like 06. You know, it's like, yeah, there was a really...
But you guys beginning supplanted. And again, Marin wasn't on camera either, right?
None of those
guys were.
No, because it wasn't... I mean, in 2009, YouTube was really only a few years old at that point.
Right.
And so the idea of like...
Right.
Of like shooting video, it's just like, well, this is really just sort of an audio format. And then it became a video format. And again,
it's literally video killed the radio star all over again. Because it is the whole point of what was so lovely about it and is so lovely about it is the auditory experience of feeling like you're in the middle of somebody's private conversation.
You're in the room. And it's like, and when you have the headphones on, you're like, it's consumed very intimately. And also just, I feel like it's so, the audio only part is just so chill because it's just like, we're just having a conversation.
Right.
And like, but even just this kind of basic setup, you know.
Well, this looks like a living room. I think we can both agree. This is a very tasteful Hollywood living room.
This feels like the living room of a henchman from an 80s
100%
action comedy.
In Tarzana. Yeah, it's there, and I was going to say, like, pleather. Thank you for being generous about the henchmen because it's also very porn adjacent. This is an easy to clean surface,
neutral background.
It's the whiff of Fabulosa in the air. A cleaning.
Well, we're at SIR Studios in Hollywood, which is like this is generally like a band rehearsal.
Yeah, I
space.
Think I have actually rehearsed on this stage.
Did
it
you?
Seems very familiar to me.
Did you rehearse for the Christmas shows here?
Probably. Yeah.
By the way, I got tickets for my mom to your Christmas show the last year. And she just said it was one of the greatest shows she had ever seen. My mom adores you so much.
She's the best.
She's
the best. I love following her because we both talk about sports.
Yeah.
And I care about her real estate content. So I feel
come
very,
for the sports. Stay for the real estate. That's
stay for the update on the porch.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, I love it. I love it. I she's like right in my sweet spot.
You know how moms are. She goes, what are you doing? I go, oh, I'm just in town. I want to do a podcast. So, who's it with? Oh, my friend Anna. Gasteyer. Yeah. Then there's the dramatic pause. Would you please just tell her how much I adore her? Of course I will. That show that I saw of hers.
I don't know what was in the water. I felt like it was so sloppy and I had such a good night out here. People were so, maybe one thing I will say, well, you know, Christmas is perennial. So I basically do the same show every year. You've seen it. I mean, more or less. But I do think because it's traditional and because it's repetitive and because you come back to it after each increasingly horrific year since 2019, it's really comforting to people, which is such a nice thing to be a part of.
Yes,
you know?
It's like I know every year we're going to go to like our Halloween mazes.
Yeah, right.
They're relatively the same. I know that, you know, like when we go to Disneyland for their, like there's variation.
You do Disney Christmas?
We do.
It's unbelievable.
It's incredible.
I had never done Disneyland Christmas because I've done, have you ever narrated the Candlelight Processional?
No, but that would be a dream.
You should throw your hat in that ring. I mean, you have to, I'll probably never get to do it again now that I say this on your podcast, but you have to like really... really lean into your Jesus for a minute.
Sure.
Like, so because it's very religious.
Yes.
The actual candlelight processional. Now, I happen to be a person who finds music very spiritual. There are 8 heralding trumpets.
Sure.
There are 600 voices.
Okay.
There's a 52-piece orchestra. So it is very hard to not feel completely swept away by the experience. But anyway, so I've done that a few times because they treat you like they roll out the red carpet. Like they put us in the suite. One year at the Polynesian where the Beatles broke up, apparently. Like, stuff like that.
Oh my
I mean,
gosh.
Like, beautiful. The housing is incredible. You get the guide. You, like, run... It's unbelievable. So, my family, while I am channeling the Lord, our Lord Jesus Christ...
Of course.
And the story of his birth, they are, like, out, like, let's do this right again! Anyway,
is
the reason I bring all this up is that I finally, for the first time, went to Disneyland just for fun.
Yeah.
At Christmas, and I had never seen the Tim Burton Haunted Mansion.
You'd never seen the Nightmare
on Elm
Street?
No, because they don't do that in Florida. I've only done Christmas in Florida. This
you know
is the
that's
whole point
weird.
Of my boring
I know
story.
A lot of Disney trivia. I don't think I know. I don't think I knew they didn't do the Nightmare Overlay in Orlando.
There were a couple of things that they don't do.
It's a different mansion. Like every park has its own themed mansion.
Okay.
So in Florida, it's much more gothic and brick. And here it's like themed around New Orleans. It's
yeah,
like a,
right.
it's an old school mansion. There's more of the doom buggies. There's more space. So they take you through more of the ride.
Right,
there's
okay.
like, you know, like bigger spaces there. But,
no,
but
the Christmas explosion was something I'd never seen. It was so great.
It's the only time of year I can do Small World.
Oh my God. It was so cute.
It's gorgeous. The front of it is so gorgeous.
It was
and then
fantastic.
Inside, yeah.
I know. That's the other one I was trying to think of. It was so fun.
Yeah, it is fun. So we like to
and
go
the little,
seasonally.
The little Christmas tree soft serves.
It's so good.
Come on.
So it's definitely, that's definitely our jam. And we definitely go every year for that. And I think the reason that I brought it up is saying, like, of course people can see your show every year.
Yeah.
Because it's been about a year.
Yep.
And we kind of like the habit of having these touch points that we can rely on to like be relatively the same once a year because it feels familiar and
comforting.
It's nice and it's traditional.
Yep.
So people could go see your show like, you know, every year. And
if I had my druthers, I would just do it at Christmas time because I love Christmas music. And also because, as you know, my music tends to be a little bit throwbacky and old timey. And I find that more annoying in August, but in like at Christmas, it's just a good fit
because
you're already listening to like Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and people.
Yeah.
It's a very, the Christmas canon is so historically, you know, White Christmas is still the top selling Christmas standard of all time.
Wow.
And if you look at those Billboard lists, they're most of the songs in the top 50 were written over 50 years ago. Which is kind of amazing. The highest compliment, because I tried to write our Christmas, the original Christmas music that we put on the album.
For Sugar and Booze.
For Sugar, yeah, that one's called Sugar and Booze. So like the title track, Sugar and Booze. I wanted music to sound, to fit into that so that it could seamlessly play on a Spotify algorithm with some of that traditional music. So
it's fucking funny. We have to think about algorithms now.
I mean, you know, or like highest compliments, like WNYC has like holiday standards and like I'm on the holiday standards channel opposed to the like, you know, Mariah Carey channel, which is a great channel too, but you know, has its, it sort of makes it. Anyway, somebody came up to me at an opening this spring and was like, your version of Sugar and Booze is my favorite version. I was like, well, I wrote it, so I hope so.
Who else?
How many other versions are there?
Are there people like,
I think
did that
like
become
drag
a standard?
Queen. No, I mean, I have no idea. Every year,
A
lot of drag queens do it, of course.
That's amazing.
I'll just get it in my Instagram and stuff like that.
It's really great, but I also imagine there was probably a time where someone went to Sinatra in the 60s and were like, all right, Frank, we're going to try to do a Christmas in July album, and there is probably like a Christmas in July.
Yeah, there probably is.
Break out the sand, it's like snow, shut the fuck up. You know, there's probably some kind of weird Rat Packy, like they tried to brand and market like halfway. Why couldn't we have Christmas
Bruners.
In July? Yeah, there was probably
but
something like that.
That's a pretty modern idea, Christmas in July. I actually think that's, I'm telling you, as the world becomes more desperate, it's like Hallmark, you know, like when the pandemic hit, like whatever.
Yeah.
March 13th, March 14th of that week, Hallmark re-released all their Christmas movies because they were like, you know what the people need? Christmas movies.
There's no shortage of a lady who can't get out of her own way going to a small town with her big city ideas and falling in love with a guy who, it turns out, is a prince.
He's an absolute prince. But Rachel and I, Dratch and I, wrote this Christmas movie.
I was going to say the Clusterfunk Christmas is like a fucking instant classic. We love that movie. It's so funny.
If you're a Hallmark fan, it's right up your alley.
But even if you're not, it's funny. But the jokes... I mean, it's like, for me, it's sort of like watching, you know, like the first time I ever saw like Police Squad or Naked Gun. It's like, oh my God, they really studied, like they
fans
of
praise,
this
by the
genre.
Way.
And so Clusterfunk Christmas is a fantastic, I really wish that you guys would get to do more of those.
We wrote another one for our old friends at Comedy Central, but then the network died. But then entertainment died. So we're not making it.
I mean, like so many stories can end that way. You know, we were about to shoot this rhythm and then the industry just died. What happened? It just died.
Everything it just fucking happening.
I don't know. We went to shoot it and then there were just flies on it.
It's so
and
sad because they were like, we want to do a franchise. We want to buy 5 movies from you guys. And we were like, how about 1? And they were like, no, we want to do 3. And we're like, we'll write 1. We'll see how it goes. And then we wrote it and then everything died. So it's really funny too. You'd really like it. It's the Clusterfunk. It's centered around the Clusterfunk sisters. They go to an ambiguous European country to do an international strudel contest, and it turns into an international espionage intrigue. Also, this part you would love because it's me and Dratch, and the way that we wrote it, of course, because there is a recurring prince theme in a lot of these royal movies. Yes. It's a whole subgenre of Hallmark Christmas and or whatever, Lifetime Hallmark. And so the two princes inexplicably, like, we're the beauty standard for that country. So the two princes inexplicably fall in love with me and Rachel, and we're like old spinsters.
It just doesn't.
But old spinsters are the thing there.
It just doesn't. It just doesn't make sense to me. Like, why? I mean, I just feel like I clearly don't understand what the business models are, because things that seem very obvious to me.
Yeah.
I guess if it worked that way, they'd be doing. I mean, I just don't know. I just know that it definitely feels like with as many outlets as there are.
Yeah.
I know more people who are like, hey, what's going? I'm not really doing anything. Like, what's the, you know? And legitimately, some of the funniest people that I know. And it just feels like, oh, there aren't as many opportunities now, or like, there's some big merger of some massive company, so all of their channels are in a spending freeze.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, okay, well, I guess
over and over and over again.
Yeah, over and over again. So
I was in a show that was 3 weeks away from season 3. The whole season had been written, and after that TBS AT&T Time Warner merger, they just started slicing shows. They just canceled the whole season.
Oh man,
it was the weirdest thing, because we were like getting ready to go, and we were paid. Like, it was cheaper to them to pay out, because we were already in pre-production,
like, and just write
and
it
not
off.
Make the move and not make the show.
Yeah,
crazy.
It is crazy, and it to me it basically. It's we're living in the age of content and not programming anymore. It's just all, you know what I mean? Which I think there's a fundamental difference. It was just like content is really just about, is really just sort of fast food. Just like, well, we'll give people something to eat, you know, as opposed to programming, which is more like, that's the entree. And then you take the time to really, craft the.
And I think it's really, so I did, sorry, I'm taking too long to explain everything, but to that point, so I did I was in an improv group in college, right? And so I don't know what was in the water in 1975, but last year, 25, was the 50th anniversary of the Groundlings Theater here, Saturday Night Live, and this improv troupe that I was a part of when I went to Northwestern called the Meow Show, which is kind of wild. Like, something was going on where people were protesting the man and making improv comedy. Like, it was sort of exploding. Anyway, so they asked me to do a panel because it was like this reunion. So I suggested a panel that was people who had done improv in college and sort of how they ended up using that skill, because they were a lot of show business related. They were like people who became showrunners and people who became performers and actors. But I was like, how about the people who just like were sort of improv comedy stars, and how do they use that in a real job?
Yeah.
That grown-ups have.
Yeah.
And they were, it was kind of interesting. There was like a community organizer for Obama, and there was like a guy that ran his family's candy company, and a lot of people in advertising. Anyway, this one guy, and they maybe put him on there, and I'm getting somewhere, I promise. It was a younger guy. They're like, he's a content creator. And my like dinosaur Gen X brain, of course, was like, so annoyed, like a TikTok, whatever. But we were talking about it, and he's like, where improv is so helpful, because I think our brains are still set to what you just said about programming.
Right.
And refinement and making something have, lasting value and depth.
Yeah.
Even if it's stupid comedy, we want it to have that like theme or whatever.
Sure.
And he was like, the biggest difference is that this whole generation is just generating material constantly.
Yeah.
Like that they are, that the number, you don't know when something's going to go viral. You cannot plan it. And you have to just shit out something
I mean,
every
that's,
day.
That's so insightful, and it's true.
It's scary, and it's scary to me, right? Like, I show up here, and I'm like, well, I'm not in full hair makeup. Like, the idea of having to do that every day, even though I love making things, and that's what I do for a living, doing it in a sloppy way is very threatening to me.
Because we were trained to workshop.
Right.
And especially with Groundlings, you had, right, like, you know, before you made it to Saturday Company, you had to do the Sunday Company.
Right.
Or, and then before that, you would, you know, you would do like the gas show or the Crazy, right, Uncle Joe show, or shows where you'd like work out.
Yes.
And then you'd get up to, and then you would hone the sketches,
yes,
down.
Same with
stand up. Find the funniest parts. The sketches would have an arc. There'd be a beginning, a middle, the endings, which were the hardest to write. And then, and same with stand up.
Yep.
And now it's just like, you have 3 seconds to grab someone's, yep, attention as they're rifling through. And it's just a fundamentally different,
yeah,
approach. And the people who are successful at it have no problem, nor should they, putting up like,
right,
50 videos that,
right,
might be kind of the same until,
right,
they find the right. They are, their workshopping is in real time.
Yes.
And they, because they know, like, well, if I put up 50 of these, if 49 of them aren't great, the algorithm's not going to, no one's going to see them.
Right.
So it doesn't matter.
Right.
So their workshopping process just looks a little different than ours does. And
even
we have
with
a problem
like my
with
Christmas
that,
act,
a
you know,
problem.
My social media, she's a lady. My name is Beverly and I do socials.
I do social media.
My friend Kelly, who helps me with social media, who's incredible, you know, young and Gen Z and fast thinking and whatever. And she's always, I'm like, don't put that joke up because I use it. Like, I don't, you know, I get worried, like, if there's something that I want live. And she's like, no, but you have to, people are goldfish. Like,
yeah,
you have to put, it's fine.
Yeah.
But you can put all of that up. You can tell the joke again.
Yeah.
Nobody will care.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I'm like, but I didn't like the phrasing. Yeah. It is. It's a challenge. It's like an elasticity that we don't necessarily have that I would like to learn a little bit more.
Yeah.
I guess.
And it really is sort of breaking out of our, like, my sketch writing, or I'm not a sketch writer, but I mean, with my approach to social media, I've had to break out of,
yeah,
my like SCTV, Kids in the Hall,
yeah,
classic SNL, 6 to 12 minute long sketches where there's like a character and an arc and it.
I know.
And it's like, no. It's already, you know, 9 minutes to, you just got it, like one quick idea.
It's really hard. Because my preference is for the former, not even as a performer, like as an audience member.
Sure.
I enjoy sketches on SNL, for example, that are, you know, beginning, middle, and end, and find the game and play it and all those things. But increasingly, I think the material even on SNL tends to be influenced by what you're describing, which is just like an absurdist moment that is fast and furious and we're out.
And now we briefly pause to thank our sponsor for this episode of the I Think You're Overthinking It podcast, BetterHelp. You know, obviously, because the show is called I Think You're Overthinking It, there's a lot of mental health undertones and overtones in some cases. You know, how do we navigate the world? How do we help with thought spiraling? How do we, you know, make sure that we're being prepared and then, but then not going so far overboard with thinking that we think ourselves into an action? And, you know, for me, I've greatly benefited from therapy. You know, obviously, you can get advice from anywhere online. There's no shortage of places you can go. And even that feels like an overload of information about mental health and wellness. So how do you navigate it all? You know, using trusted resources, talking to live therapists can help you get personalized recommendations and help you break through all the noise. BetterHelp can help you with over 30,000 therapists. It is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. It's convenient. You can join a session with a therapist at the click of a button and help you fit therapy into your busy life. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Hardwick, my last name, HARDWICK. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/Hardwick. And I would like to thank them for sponsoring I Think You're Overthinking It. And now let us return to the program.
I right before you got here, I was playing delicious dish from 2010 with Betty White.
Okay.
The Dusty Muffin sketch. And I said to Kaylin, like, it was 2010.
Wow.
And I said to Kaylin, like, it's a perfect sketch because you know the premise.
Yeah.
It's basically, it allows you and Molly to make a million amazing jokes in this zone. Then it escalates because then Betty White comes in halfway through. She escalates it. And then it just, the sketch lands on a joke and it ends. It's 6 minutes.
Yeah.
It's like a perfect.
That's great.
It's a perfect sketch. And I know that it had already been done. You'd already been doing the characters at that point. So people knew. But it just, it really was like, it was just, it was a perfect morsel of like, oh yeah, this is, there's no air in this sketch.
Yeah.
It's just a perfect 6 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, that was our style back then. That was how we were trained and what we were meant to do. Now, I will say, so Will and I did Bobby and Marty, and I think it was 12 minutes. It was long at Radio City. But in part, it was just one of those weird nights where that is in part what made it successful, because the evening was all these rock bands, you know, in Radio City, whatever, 6,000 people, 5,000 people. So the sort of quietness of them, but and specifically knowing that we weren't, I was talking to Bobby Moynihan about this the other day. We were on the only work that anyone gets anymore, which was game shows. We were on a game show together. So, but the thing is, when you're in the middle of a 8H sketch and you're in the studio, you're so conscious of time.
Right.
Or I am. The whole time, you know that like, the longer you spread, you probably poach somebody else's chances later down in the hour.
Right.
Possibly your own sketch is going to get cut or like, you know, so I was always aware of like the momentum of having to keep things going. And I liked slow characters. So it was sort of agony. But it was so fun at Radio City because we actually could just take our time. We knew we weren't breaking a commercial.
Right.
We had the advantage of being in streaming. We could swear. We could take, we took a lot of beats that we did not rehearse, just because the audience was riding with it. And, you know, it was a live crowd.
To be in a live setting, like, once the audience is kind of on board.
They were so on board.
Then you really have the ability to let it breathe. But that's the live show experience. That's just what's so great and why it's, you just can't replicate that. And especially, like, once you put things on TV, it really does kind of change the dynamic. Like, if you're shooting a comedy special or if you're shooting sketch or whatever, because you can, there are so many things that can be carried by the energy of the room.
Yeah.
That when you watch stuff on TV sometimes, I mean, when you think about like, oh, well, that's why they have laugh tracks.
Right.
Because there need to be some indicator to the audience at home that it was not only these are the parts that are funny, but that people are caught up in the energy. And so, but you're still removed from it by a degree by watching on a box. So
as a
like,
producer, what's your thought? I'm genuinely curious, like to what helps that experience for the audience? Is it cutting to the audience?
At home?
Is it? Yeah.
Well, it can be either, so it's a couple things. It can either be cutting to the audience, or which often is used to cover an edit point, or just the hearing that the audience is really, you know, there's so many supercuts on YouTube and Instagram or whatever of like, oh, here's a supercut of people breaking on SNL, of like cast members breaking, and feeling that the energy is palpable. You can tell that everyone on set is having a good time and the audience is losing it, and that can be infectious even if you're looking at it on a little phone. But when you're watching something, it really does, it relies a lot on more of the strength of the jokes than the energy of the room to carry it.
Yeah.
You get a little more forgiveness live because you can get caught up in the energy. So it's focusing on making sure the jokes are really solid so that people watching can laugh regardless of the audience there.
Yep.
But it is trying to figure out how to create that environment of fun, basically, that the people there are experiencing when you're not there and you're watching on, a phone.
It is a really dissociated. I'm also just curious because specials themselves seem popular. I could be wrong about that.
They are. They're popular on YouTube now. What's weird is that YouTube. Netflix does a bunch. Like Netflix does a handful.
I thought Netflix is. I thought one of the big reveals of their. Remember when they had to reveal their viewership or whatever after the strike? I thought one of the big dirty secrets was that the comedy specials didn't do as well as they
Oh, I didn't hear that. I would have thought I would have heard something about that. I don't know. I don't know if it's like, because obviously they can tell how long people are watching. Right. So it's like, oh, they're only watching 14 minutes. I mean, yeah. But, you know, like YouTube has been really good for comedy because, you know, there are not a lot of outlets to do stand up on television anymore. Right. It's like there's Netflix, HBO does a couple. Amazon will do a couple. I think Hulu did a handful.
Yeah, Hulu.
But outside of that, like, Comedy Central's not doing them anymore. So no. As far as I know, maybe they are as of the airing of this, but I don't think so. And so YouTube really was a great way to just directly connect to people's audiences. And there are hour-long comedy specials that like 2, 3, 4, 5 million people are watching. So
that's a lot of people.
There is, yeah. So the audiences are there. It's just finding, it's like, how do you connect with them? How do you kind of rise above the cacophony of everyone making stuff? And now you have this beautiful steeplechase of having to, I just call it like sword fighting with invisible robots, which is the algorithm.
Right.
It's like, because often people go like, well, people aren't watching your stuff. Maybe your stuff sucks. And it's like, maybe.
No.
You know, as content creators, we do have to make good stuff. However, there are so many super secret reasons for why a platform will show stuff to people depending on time of day or what sort of features of their own thing they're pushing or what the fucking thumbnail is. It's like,
and people
so
don't even
things.
Realize that, like, in terms of the machines winning, like, people don't know that the 10 things that Netflix are suggesting to you are different than the ones
of course they are.
It's surprising how many people don't know that. Well, they're like, oh, this is the number one world trending on blah blah blah, and you're like, no, it's not. It's
in all, your silo.
Literally. You know, which is fine, that's sort of the gift of it, but it's
yeah, if you ever really want to see it in action, what you have to do is sign out of YouTube and look at it on another browser, not sign in. You're like, oh my God, there's like a whole other fucking world, you know, like, so we are really in this kind of like weird soft robot apocalypse where we're all
it's not that soft.
I just mean soft in terms of like, we always thought the robot apocalypse, like Terminator promised us that the robot apocalypse would be like, you know, like a skeletal metal man stepping on a soccer field full of human skulls. And now it's just like telling you like, hey, here's a bunch of stuff that you think is the world, but it's really just you, but your opinion is now a fact.
We are now run by a Nigerian prince.
we should have let him park that $3 million in our accounts.
It is crazy.
He was mad.
You get the robot calls, the text calls.
Oh yeah.
And my friend Tony writes really funny replies and posts them on Instagram. So I thought that would be a funny thing to also do. So I got, you know, like a, and here's how I know they called me. They were like, Jadwiga, you won a contest. And I wrote back like, I wish that I could claim it, but I cannot let any of my sister wives know or they'll kill me. Please come get me, but I'm in the compound. Let me know and I will meet you at the perimeter. Okay. So thinking I was funny, right? Took a picture of it, and then I have paid so dearly for it because I hear from someone for Jadwiga at least 15 times a day. And I just block, 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 and it doesn't stop.
Now, is this where that's going to end up being like your online identity, and then it's going to pull your personality is going to split, and you're going to have Jadwiga as your matrix.
Yeah, it's my other personality. It's
your
exactly
other personality,
it
but
is.
It's going to take over, and in some fucked up Black Mirror way, you're going to become this other. Yeah. That other person's going to.
I'm
going
to end up offering free healthcare to lots of people around the world.
That's what's going to happen.
And a contest and a shopping cart.
That's
it's all stuff
happen.
Like that. Like I don't even understand what it is with the content. It's all things about your healthcare and you know your points. You have more points available and your shopping cart.
There are some where I'm like, what's the end game on this? Like I am calling to tell you about your healthcare, or the ones that are.
The insurance one?
The insurance one. There's a lot of insurance one. There's the...
I think it's so they can steal your identity.
Probably.
I think it's like so that they... Well, because I just saw one like where people just send people stuff And then you don't know what it is. You're like, wait, did we order a new shower caddy? And there's no information. And then there's a barcode. If you scan the barcode, which people are inclined to do, sure, when they don't know where the fuck something came from.
Right.
And then that will install malware and steal your life.
Absolutely. Listen, if you ordered it, if you weren't aware that
and
you
SAT
ordered,
scores.
You might have sleep ordered a shower caddy.
Well, that's
on,
the problem.
On Amazon.
Because then if you have Ambien in the middle of the story, then it gets really complicated.
Honey, I may have ordered a shower caddy, but I think
I've been known to do that.
I think it's going to make sense for me to give them my social security number. To get the shower. It's just sitting at customs.
It's just sitting at
How
customs.
How am I going to get into my fucking house?
I really need the shower caddy.
It really makes a lot of sense. The other one is the like, you didn't pay this toll.
We
so,
just got hundreds and hundreds of toll
and,
bills.
And the thing that's really upsetting is you know some poor, you know, like elderly person who doesn't know any better is going to be like,
Oh, and my parents many times have done that. Like my mom's like, I clicked on United, but I ended up buying, like if she doesn't know that the search engines are purchased.
Right.
So the first thing that comes up, she thinks is the right thing. It's all happened very fast, I feel.
Yeah.
And, it is tempting to throw your phone in the sea.
There are like YouTube videos where people who are like professional hackers will engage with the people who are phishing and then hack their computers and like steal and then like wreck
like
their,
Robin Hood it
in a way. Yeah
I kind of appreciate that.
that might be your
that's
new
my
rabbit hole.
Yeah, Jadwiga.
That's
that's gonna be my alter ego.
That's your matrix
identity.
I'm
gonna steal from fishers and give to the Jadwigas.
That's right. You're gonna fish the fishers.
I'm gonna fish the fishers. That's, fuckers.
Yeah. If you do that, I think there's a future for you that you had not even seen before, like a whole different type of programming.
Well, I mean, shouldn't there just be like an old fashioned TV show called Name That Troll and like make the troll? Like, don't you want to meet all these assholes? Just see what they look like?
Yeah, just like to see it.
Who's like the people making fun of you? Like people, the negative commenters.
I know, but it's not, it's rarely about you. It's like you, in a lot of cases, yeah, there are some people who are just chaotic evil and they just want to watch the world burn, but then there are other people who are just sad, you know? It's like they've just had a tough
day.
They're just not happy because like people who are, they've either had a tough day, so something happened in a moment. You know, I've engaged people like before, like, why would you say, oh, I was just having a weird day, but I didn't mean anything by it, sorry. And, you know, like, there are people who just think like, look, you're interfacing with text and a machine. So like all of those,
say whatever you want.
All of those interpersonal, like human survival cues are not present because I'm not in front of you and I can't see that you're a person.
Either
and I'm
about
not
to kill you or that you feel sad or that you've had a rough
moment.
You're
watching it on a phone, which is now that I think about it, it's like, oh, it's kind of funny. We were talking about how do you present comedy in the same way that people, fucking troll you.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, you're disconnected from the human experience.
This is what is the helix, the brain ache of social, right? Is that this whole world around which we could connect to people, right?
Yeah.
The eternal argument of, you know, oh, well, think about the gay kid in Indiana and how they can find their community, right? That's always like this idea that there's some kind of community has so quickly become bastardized. You mentioned Peloton. A friend of mine wrote this book about the wellness industries, basically like the sort of cult of wellness. And SoulCycle like was one of the things, and that kind of idea that, you know, everybody instead of church now just like I'm going to SoulCycle, man, you know, and they're
what
I'm
community
gonna,
you're talking about
you're
like
looking,
everyone's
you're looking
just
for
looking
community,
for their community. Yeah.
But you're looking for community in a dark room on like a fake bike staring straight ahead of yourself, so you're not actually engaging in community. You're kind of, it's like being on the internet.
Well, that's,
you're kind of in parallel to everything. So Peloton was developed thinking, oh, people want to do it at home. But then ultimately what they found out is that people were so engaged by that leaderboard and wanting to be a part of whatever, like Wine and Spin or whatever, like clubs, that some of the first meetups in real life of Peloton, my friend went to one, 50 people were there, 7 people had Peloton tattoos, which is kind of crazy. That's a really high number of people to have one, you know, apart
like
from
a brand.
Yeah. Apart from Mickey Mouse or whatever. You know what I mean? Like
that, but that one's okay.
That one's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's OG.
OG. Yeah.
But what I find fascinating about it is that's how much people want community. They want to connect with people. They want, so I feel like the sort of evil joke of social is that it's
Isolating.
Yeah, it is isolating.
Yes, it was this thing that was supposed to connect
us. Sorry, was that a duh thing?
No, it wasn't a duh thing. We're thinking exactly in parallel because I often think about like how it's sold to us like, hey, it's going to be this, you know, it's this connective tissue. And it's like, yeah, but the way you interact with this is alone. It's really isolating.
Really isolating.
And I think it's not an accident that since pandemic, like the like, especially with, you know, like stand up and music shows, the live show business has been fucking insane.
I keep saying this, like, and same in thing, a like, great way. And Broadway too. Broadway is exploding. I'm like, because people are so relieved to sit together, experiencing something.
Yes, they want communal experiences. Yes. They want IRL experiences because, you know, they are, even if they can't articulate it, they are feeling this sort of isolation of like, oh, I'm interacting with everything on my phone, and even though it seems like we live in this weird consumer utopia where you can watch on a 100-inch TV anything in the history of entertainment and a fucking drone will just fly a pizza right into your gaping maw.
Yeah.
You know, that what we really actually crave is connection.
Yeah.
And we're feeling disconnected even though technologically it seems like we should be more connected than ever. But really...
But the algorithm is also organized around anger, and it's organized around those stronger emotions, so it's feeding you
whatever
loneliness.
Is engaging is what it's, you know,
but people are more engaged by fury, they always are,
and they're more engaged by fear, which is why the news will be like,
right,
9 household items can kill you, tune in at 11, shit, I better, you know, that's why the top news stories aren't like kid finds a kitten and they live happily, you know, it's like it's all of the doom and gloom and scary stuff because that gets your attention.
Well, my algorithm is people falling on ring cams. I'm very basic. I'm really Gen X. And dogs swimming.
Dogs, and, swimming dogs.
My daughter just sent me a dog clamming.
What is, I'm not sure. Oh,
diving,
you're looking for
like
clams.
Feeling around and then diving for a clam.
Oh, I thought that
it's
was
the greatest
maybe
thing I've ever
some
seen.
Odd porn category.
I watched it
that
at least 45 times. It was so uplifting.
If someone was like, my dog is clamming, I'd be like, is that allowed?
And it was music. It was fun, uplifting.
That, yes, that. My stuff is so fucking boring. Like when I look at what I'm being shown on YouTube, it's literally music theory, like piano and guitar instruction, and then a bunch of like mindfulness stuff.
Oh yeah,
but it started to
that's pretty great.
It started fishing to see how woo woo I am.
Yeah, I've had that happen
because I'll start to get these videos where like it.
Those make you angry fast.
If you see this, only a select few people will see this is about to change your life. So I'm like, oh fuck, I gotta see
now
like
gotta see
what
how it's
the
do it.
And of course, like a lot of time it's some AI voice and some like AI text that they probably made in Canva. And it's just so funny to me. It's like we watch things for a lot of different it's not like I'm watching because I believe it.
No.
I'm watching because I'm fascinated.
You're intrigued.
But now it's like, oh my God, this guy's really into
how many steps?
Yeah, he's the only person who's gonna see this video.
I have that with hip openers. They keep sending me like earthy guys in like bad drawstring shorts doing like if you do this one low back hip exercise daily, because I'm intrigued. I'm like, it'll, you know, they're like you'll age fast, less fast or something. Like, you know, like if you know how to do, because one person told me that if I could one time, that if I could stand on one foot for the full 2 minutes of brushing my teeth, so now I do that, like I
that helps your hips.
No, supposedly, it was actually competitive because they said the amount of time that you can stand on one foot at a time is an indicator of aging.
Okay.
So I got out of bed and I tried.
Just to check. Were you doing it like, a welfare check on yourself?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Okay, can I stand up?
It was in the middle of the night, so it was a little wobbly. And so then I was like, great, I'm just going to do this 2 minutes is how long the electric toothbrush goes. So I do it once in the morning on the left foot, once in the evening on the right foot. And then as a result of that, the internet has just served me endless hip opening and pelvic
those are so dangerous for me to watch, because if I were standing on one foot and then I slightly fell off balance, I'd call my doctor and be like, so do I have a neurological disorder?
Yeah, you know, it's
like,
that's exactly right,
because I think we're, especially as we get well into middle age, we just do a lot of extra welfare checks, like I don't know, this one ear feels a little quieter than the others, everything, oh, what am I, I've been bumping into things a lot. What is that? And it's like, well, you're just decaying. I don't know what else to tell you. There's no specific thing wrong.
You've got 30 years. It's a slow descent. you'll be all right.
You're slowly being reclaimed by the earth. What do you want? Like, I don't know what to tell you. There's not like a specific thing.
No, stop running.
You're definitely in the zone of where that's not unlikely. I've also been starting to get a lot of like toddler parenting, because our daughter's 3 and a half.
Right.
And we are in the throes of potty training. training right now. Fun. And so this is one of the rabbit holes that I've been down. Yeah. And you've obviously been down it twice.
I potty trained before the internet.
You did.
Thank God.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because I feel like there are so many, like, potty train your child in a day and a half. And it's like, oh, it's a little more complicated.
I really feel for you because parenting is bad enough with, like, the, you know, unmerited public opinion, the right way. Everybody thinks the way they did it's the right way. It's so unscientific. It's really like what your kid and your family has figured out for you guys that works. And nobody else's philosophies. And that was bad enough with parenting books. Like when I was, you know, I have a 23-year-old and a 17-year-old. So that's the other weird thing. Is
they
the
are potty
6 years.
Yes.
One is not.
Okay.
But I don't want to name.
Sure. Which is it? one is it?
You can guess. it was the pre-internet one. But it's crazy because the first one, you know, like we did TV shows and Nickelodeon and whatever. And then by the second one, within that 6 year span in 2008, my son was born and it was all YouTube. And I remember it was like when he would watch TV, like as a 3-year-old or whatever, it was truck videos. It would be like a straight, just YouTube algorithmic channel of like construction.
Oh yeah, just like the big
diggers and all that when it was during that phase.
Loaders
and his brain bulldozers. Is really different as a result. Like the way that he interacts with content is totally different than
and
the way my daughter
does. And instead
of
saying good morning, he says like and subscribe.
He does.
That's right. He's always Hey guys.
Yeah.
my friend Mike Furman and I were
so today we're unboxing.
We were unboxing the cereal. You're just having cereal, but it's unboxing. It's unboxing. Mike and I were trying to figure out like if there was an evolutionary chain that just singled out like the influencers in 1,000 years. They would be like the Martians from Mars Attacks, but instead of ack, 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 it would be like.
Black
guys,
Mirror.
Guys. Like.
Black Mirror.
Is that a Black Mirror episode?
Yeah, people have likes, like their actual personalities.
Oh, you mean like on, like in the Bryce Dallas Howard episode where they were like rating each, like everyone had to get above a certain.
Yeah.
I just mean that language would be reduced to like.
Like and subscribe. Like and subscribe.
Like subscribe.
Like and subscribe.
Guys.
Check out my Substack.
Guys.
Check out my Substack as always.
It is. It's so, you know, it's just like the general like theme of the podcast now is this is like overthinking and how. And I feel like it's so easy now to overthink because there's so much stimuli in every direction that our brains, we have to force ourselves to unplug, you know, even from the stuff when we're trying to, you know, like you said, like just get healthy or find health or in my case, like, you know, in Lydia, in my case, like, oh, well, what are some effective ways that we can help? Because there's really no logical reason if you're a 3-year-old why you should not wear a diaper. You've had one on literally your entire life.
100%.
You can pee whenever you want. Yeah. Someone else just swaps it out for you.
Yeah.
Why do I have to go sit on a weird thing that, you know, that, like sit on a hole basically and go to the bathroom in that? It's way more cumbersome.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we were starting to get really stressed because
you have to for school and stuff.
Well, there's but there is a lot of like, you know, a little bit of unspoken like parent shaming, like, oh, you didn't potty train them like
I'm
a day and a half.
You.
And we've talked to some other parents up where we live who were so awesome because they were like, every kid is different. It's not likely, like none of our kids were potty trained in like 48 hours. Like it's a process. Sometimes they'll do it. Sometimes they won't. You just stick with it. Eventually it'll, you know.
Yeah.
And we were so relieved to hear that. But that was IRL. We had to talk to people in real life, not
on. You have to go over to somebody else's house and see their family be as weird as yours. And no, it's the same thing with, don't you feel like with sleeping, like with sleep training babies, people are psycho, you know, and whatever. And sometimes babies do lie down and sleep for 8 hours. Mine never did. Like they, you know, but different people have different routines and they get really self-righteous and smug about it. And then they end up having one that's a terrible sleeper, which is what happened to me. You know, so much of it is one thing I will say is they do eventually grow up, not walk in on you when you're going to the bathroom,
right?
Go to the bathroom by themselves,
yes,
put themselves to bed,
yep,
all of these things happen. It feels like it's not going to happen. It feels glacial. And it is kind of mind-blowing, like, if you, in those first 5 years, where you're like, I have to teach someone to tie their shoes?
Yeah,
like,
because
how
you never
do you do that?
You never think about, like, how you do it.
Yeah.
So to teach, like, oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to, like, my son ate nothing. I mean, he was, like, one of the, and my mother is not ashamed of judging anybody, and particularly outspoken on the subject of picky eaters. She has open disdain for picky eaters. So, of course, I had one, because that's how the world
works. That's the universe,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, same with, like, hoarding and purging. Like, I am always giving things away, and I gave birth to a hoarder, and my mother's a hoarder. Like, you know, it just, all these things skip a generation.
Well, so, the best piece of parenting advice that I got was from a friend of mine who said, a lot of parents, she's like, you know, there's this weird kind of fucked up hazing that parents will do where
totally
they'll go
true.
Like, wherever you're at,
yeah,
they doom and gloom you, where it's like, oh, you're about to start potty training.
Oh, good
fucking
luck.
Get ready, because your life is going to, and it's like, why are you doing that? You know? And so this person said to me, like, look, it is work, but it's good work, and it's fine. It's all fine. Okay. And it's lovely, and it's wonderful. And that was so relieving to me, because that's not the norm of what you hear, because people like to go, oh my God, are you fucking in for it? Oh, what they're doing? Oh,
boy.
You got to get trainers on them? Oh, good luck. Boy, oh boy, you're in for it. Oh my God, are you about to fall in a fucking magma swamp?
Every single
swamp?
Thing. And I'm telling you, I'm in the very last one, which is now college admissions for my second child. And you want to see people be fucking psychos. These people that you have had 12 wonderful potlucks years with and friendships. And then you're like, oh, I can't talk to you for a year. Because they start comparing the SAT scores and the thing and the, you know, where we're going to apply early. And oh no, this person's legacy there. And I mean, it's a nightmare. I've already been through it with one, so I'm prepared. It's the final chapter. But you just have to sort of make vows. Like, I have a few friends that were like, we're not going to talk about this at all. And we're going to be super excited when our children get into college.
I loved school. My wife did not like school. And we weirdly have met in the middle, and we fully agree on, like, look, we ultimately will not care about grades. Grades to me are so strange, because it's like, it doesn't mean that you understood, retained, or appreciated the information.
She's a good memorizer.
Can we help her? Can we help foster her, like, interest in learning? And, you know, she loves to act out scenes from movies. This feels like it was passed down. My wife loves horror movies. Our daughter is obsessed with Land Before Time because there's dinosaurs, and she started doing this thing where she wants to reenact the Littlefoot death scene, but she's the mom. So she'll be like, okay, dinosaurs, I'm the long neck, I'm mom.
Fantastic.
And then she'll just lie on the ground and then just collapse like this. And then Lydia has to be like, mother, no. I'm like, what in the fuck? I mean, I would say what in the fuck in front of the kid, but it's just like, but privately, I'm like, why does she? You know, there's so many kids that would be traumatized by that, but she's like, this is a real creative moment that we really
need to recreate.
And she really does, like, do the whole thing, and we yes and, like, everything that she does.
You have to.
Were your kids performers in that way?
Yes, especially my daughter, who is a performer, turned out to be one. But yeah, like, same thing. Like she wanted to be the stepsisters, you know, like, she wouldn't want to be Cinderella.
Right.
Like, and she'd be like, if you were the stepmother, she'd be like, be meaner. You know, like, we would have babysitters who were like, she wants me to keep yelling at her. Like, it feels kind of weird.
But in retrospect, it's like, it's probably not a surprise that your daughter's probably really funny, because she
is. I mean, they're both funny. They're your daughter will be too. I mean, you know, they're fun and fun to do stuff with. And again, like, if anything, my son is now, he's more in, like, his rebellion is that he's more of, like, an ascetic. Like, I've told you, he's, like, a very serious cross-country runner, and he, like, goes and does his, he's very, like, you know, disciplined and body as a temple and very focused. And I think he will hopefully be fun again, but that's his rebellion, is to, like, not make armpit farts at dinner. Because he's been, like, you know, going to Disney World for Christmas.
The body's a temple. Would you make a church door fart? I don't know. I wouldn't.
I would.
Yeah.
Okay, I probably would, obviously.
Too. Yeah, I probably would, too.
Wait,
yeah,
I wanted to ask you a question. When you were talking about the mindfulness thing, so, and back to, like, the internet is terrible.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like there's another irony in there, right? Where you're seeking peace and calm inside the algorithm.
Yes.
By accident. Like, I keep buying, and it's so seductive, where you're, you know, like, My daughter calls, like, when you all take a break and you stare at your phones, she calls it enrichment time, which makes me laugh. She's like, hey guys, it's enrichment time. And then we'll all like stare at our phones. What are your like hacks for that? Because every now and again it takes incredible discipline. I'm trying to do that thing where I leave the phone in another room.
Right.
Like that. Did you see that commencement address from the Bates lady? She was at Bates College, and it was like a whole thing about like, it literally, if the phone is in the room with you, you are less productive. The studies have shown you have to put it in a different room entirely.
It's like a kryptonite that you have to like put it in lead.
Yes.
So that it can't.
So but I have a really hard time with it, but I go through phases where I force myself to read books before bed. And leave the phone in another room. But then I give up really quickly. I mean, it's like smoking or something. Like,
yeah,
it's really
hard. Well, it is very addictive.
Yeah.
And what's really fucking creepy about the devices is that we're going to, I'm sure every parent says this, but we're going to like hold it off as long as we can before, until Dimity's much older. But you can tell, even if she just sees my watch, her eyes get big and you're like,
I know.
These were fucking designed.
I know.
To just get into our lizard brains, like just right into the amygdala to be like, what is that? You know, like it just, and when I see how she reacts to stuff, it just makes me realize like, oh my God, there is no healthy way to interact with because none of it's designed healthily.
Right.
It's designed, they're consumer products. They are designed so that you will buy them and engage with them. And so for me, it's constantly reminding myself that it's a tool.
And it's a hard thing for people in our profession, because the number of times I've been like, I'm going to get rid of it. I got to get rid of the social. And that's how we communicate with our audiences.
Sure.
Like that's how we sell tickets. How many times have you done a show where they're like, well, you have to post about it. And that's how you do it. Right.
Literally every time.
Every time. Like there's not like, you're not like our marketing team's got this. I mean, but
we're our marketing team.
Exactly.
Now. Yeah.
So like my son, who, as I mentioned, was born in 2008. So his whole life has existed with these things. He has a somewhat healthier attitude. He tends to be more comfortable. Like I deleted Snapchat. Like he'll like come and go with it with much greater ease than
that's my hope is that the young generation now will see their parents, pulled into this algorithmic narcissism and be like, it's not cool. They'll just think it's not cool because it's what they see us. But like one of the most amazing things in the world is if, Dimity's doing something funny and I try to get a video or a photo of it to send to my mom, and Dimity will just stop and go, Dad, put down the phone. It's so sobering to have a 3-year-old tell you like, that's annoying, And I go, oh my God, you're right, But we feel this need to capture and share. Share. And we don't post really her at all, but like, it's just for my mom.
Yeah, of course.
Who we don't live in the same city as all the time. So it's like, I want to be able to show her, oh, she's saying new words or she's doing this funny thing. But it's forgetting that life is to be lived, not cataloged and engaged separately.
No, and I mean, and we adults are the worst at sitting down at a table and like just scrolling and staring and whatever. And it is annoying. Like I find myself, and my husband works internationally and a lot of what's happening is all work is here. So it's really hard for us, right?
You know what? It's a feedback loop. And I do think that it's sort of like why, I'm just using this example as an ex-drinker of, from 21 years ago, but it's like the more you drink, the more you're going to keep drinking because it numbs you in the moment, but then it kind of creates these other long-term anxiety problems, which make you do it more in the. And so I do think there is this kind of same thing with the scrolling is like, it creates more chatter in our heads, which we then go back to it to distract from.
Right.
Which then creates more chatter.
Right.
And I feel like a lot of times, I'm sure people like you and me are just kind of scrolling, just looking for something positive, something to feel better, and then not seeing it. Be like, oh, maybe if I try this time.
I know.
And so it
oh, it's exactly what it is.
It really is just trying to remember that, hey, maybe life is to be lived and not posted. And so, and which is hard to do, especially when it's tied to our businesses and it's so normalized.
Not just normalized, it's required. I mean, the number of, you know, meetings that you have, even with agents and representatives that
how
are like...
How many followers do you have? Yeah, that kind of like...
Yeah, or like, yeah, you know, you should really be tagging brands when you're, you know, it's like, oh.
Can I just be funny?
Yeah.
I just want to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a slog.
How do you kind of handle the... If you get in these sort of thought spirals, are you a catastrophizer?
No.
I don't pick you as a catastrophizer.
No, I'm a child of a catastrophizer. Okay. So it's a funny thing. It, again, skips a generation.
Got it. And so how do you, if you find yourself in these loops, how are you kind of processing it and dealing with it? Because I remember talking to you 12 years ago about, and you cited Will Ferrell as a guy who... You go, we do a sketch, and if it didn't well, he would just go, well, you really stank up the joint with that. And then he would just like walk away and be like, I think he's just, he's not thinking about it anymore.
No, he's the happiest. Yeah, he's not. He doesn't. That's funny. I don't know. You know, as I answered that catastrophize question, I actually don't know the answer about myself. I'm not as carefree as Will, but I am... I'm just experienced. I think something in the last 5 years has made me realize, like, I just am. I'm 57 years old. Like, I've worked for 30 years, you know, professionally, and I'm aware that a certain amount of experience just allows you to be more relaxed, you know, about a little bit, you know. I mean, of course, like, we joke, like, we're never going to work again, but I don't really think that's true. I think I'll probably work again, you know. I mean, I have slow periods. That definitely happens. I feel like I'm now, you didn't ask this question, but I'm more, I'm just, you know, more and more interested in what I want to make and how much time I have left to do it. Because I really like making stuff, and I like making stuff with my friends and with people. And that's where I get frustrated because I can't find any outlets. But I love, that's where I'm at. I think I might be in my like maker area.
Do you feel, this might be kind of a weird question, but do you feel like, do you feel in some ways like would you get your friends together and just like make sketches for social media, or do you sort of feel like, no, it kind of needs to be a more professional setting because that's what you've done for 30 years, and it would be, well, you would feel a little weird if it was just like,
it's
funny.
There's this character that I've been developing for 17 years. Like, it's incredible how just if you do your thing, you look up and it's 17 years later.
Yeah.
The reason I know this is because I started working on this character when I had just had my son, and he's 17 now.
Okay.
So, and I've like dabbled around with her. She's this Broadway diva.
I saw you posting about
she's
her.
She's on my socials, right? So,
September Davis?
September L. Davis, yes. So she's like a fucking nightmare, very hard to work with, but like, you know, talented and established. Yeah. So I've done all kinds of things. I've written songs for fake musicals that she's done. I've done, tried to develop a movie with her. I did all kinds of things. And then, out of nowhere, my friend Jason, who was artistic director of this like theater, it's a theater lab called Ars Nova. It's a comedy theater lab in New York, right? And a lot of comics have come out of there and whatever. And early on, I had worked on September there, just like done a couple readings and things like that. And just, it was living in a drawer. And he was like, hey, I'm leaving after 20 years here as artistic director. And we're doing three benefits, one with some composers I'd develop, one with some playwrights, and we would love to do an evening with you. So I just like... put the flag in the golf course.
Put the flag in the golf course. I think that's the standard. Yep.
And I was pin on the calendar, and I was like, great. I'm gonna write a show for September Davis. We have music already, and my friend Stephen Cragg, who I worked with at the Groundlings, who shared a dressing room with me, writer's room at SNL and Office. He knows the character, and we'd gone back and forth, and we wrote this insane play. Wherein she was apologizing. She's going for her sixth Tony. And she's such an ass for her one woman Sound of Music. It's like super artsy nightmare. And she realizes she's diagnosed as an asshole. And she has to so she realizes that she's an asshole. And she has to come to terms with that and make amends. The reason I bring it up is it was so unbelievably old school. I've got a wig and you bring your trunk kind of fun. I mean... these unbelievable, like Broadway people showed up, like five or six people showed up to be in it, dancers, singers. I had a band, a full band, amazing costume designers. My friend Kevin Cahoon came in and directed it. Amazing lighting designer. I mean, it was like It was like theater camp. And it was so unbelievably fulfilling and joyful.
Did you just do one show?
We just did one. We're trying to get it produced now off Broadway and see what happens. But, you know, obviously the dream would be to do it more. But really, I was shocked by the level of satisfaction I felt from making something so soup to nuts that I've been meaning to make for so long, you know? It has 6 original songs. Tom Kidd, who wrote Next to Normal, wrote a bunch of the music. It's really fun.
So how would you define the, I feel like...
And it was very un... By the way, this it's like the stage was like... The, it's a tiny little theater. It's not polished. It was, it's sort of the answer to your initial question. It wasn't like refined. I would be thrilled if, you know, Netflix wanted to produce it as like a television show.
Right.
But I honestly felt like... And I interrupted you. I apologize.
Please.
But I felt like... It was kind of a breakthrough in a strange way to just be like, I don't want to be disappointed by somebody not buying it. I want an audience. The audience loved it. It's ridiculous. It's a very theater specific idea, even though it's about apology. You know, there's a lot of inside baseball on Broadway community, which television people have always said, oh, you got to get all the theater stuff out of it because it's going to be too confusing to people. It's too inside baseball. So it's kind of refreshing just to like lean in and write the thing that it is in the space where it belongs.
But,
you know,
what's odd to me about that is like, well, but something should be authentic.
Yeah.
Because I think people read authenticity.
Totally.
And so when authenticity gets diluted out of something, they're like, it didn't work. I guess people don't really care about a Broadway. It's like, no. You took all the authenticity out of it. So a lot of the stuff didn't make sense anymore.
Right.
And so people don't necessarily have to know everything about a subject to want to watch it. If it's funny and if it's authentic.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we're comedy joke writers. Like we have a lot of jokes in there.
So I guess part of the thing for people who are listening and kind of making their own thing is I think it can be helpful to figure out like how you define the success of something.
It
can be so easy to beat yourself up and go, well, this failed, or I do this constantly, like, I posted this thing and not that many people engaged with it, so I guess I'm a failure. It's like, there's so many other reasons like that you don't have to define you.
That's right.
So with like the September L. Davis story, how do you define the success of it? Is it just that you got to make it and put it up once, or do you sort of have like a metric for how you would allow yourself to feel accomplished?
To me, the success of that was that it was incredibly fun and creative, that collaboratively, I like collaborating. It's funny because comedians are weird about collaboration. We're always like, oh, you know, did somebody steal my joke or whatever? I have owned that about myself in the last 5 years. Ever since I wrote the movie with Dratch, I love collaborating with people. I like writing with other people. I'm good at it. Everything I've ever done has been more successful by making it with another person.
Yeah.
I'm better that way. And so that collaborative effort of bringing a lot of talented people together in a really positive, put on a show energy was a huge success. And then, so it was joyful and collaborative, those two things. And I think it was authentic. It was uncompromising in that respect. It was not, it's a real asshole of a character, you know, and I have a really good time playing characters like that. It's, you know, a very Anna Gasteyer, like, classic. I did characters sometimes like that at SNL. You know, just she's very unself-aware. It was just very delightful.
Like, the American Auto character was...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's true. But yeah, like, there was a character I did, Deander Wells. And again, I have no idea if this thing could be successful or not. But, yes, so defining success was putting the deadline together, achieving it, motivating other people to be a part of your party, and helping them to feel fulfilled as a part of that experience. And of course, for the audience to have a good time.
Yeah.
But pulling it off in a way that didn't feel like lazy, or it's funny, it's the opposite of what we were saying about these TikTok things, but at the beginning, but it felt thorough. It felt like a, you know, hour and a half, fully beginning, middle, and end conceived piece of theater with some pathos and some... It's mostly ridiculous, but there is some authenticity to what happens in these conversations. It deals with addiction. It deals with, you know, making amends, which I think is just an interesting idea. So, and then the music, you know, it's like we wrote songs from, there's some stuff in there you would love. We wrote a fake Lin-Manuel show called String Theory about quantum physics. And we wrote the most ridiculous rap, you know, that this guy does. It's just stuff like that. And we wrote a number from Hindenburg the musical. We wrote. It was fun. It was fun.
I hope you get to do this more.
Me too.
So just walk me through a little bit. Like, is it really just about finding someone to put up the money for it? Is that really sort of the base, or is it like find? That's it.
It's finding like somebody who's passionate and excited and has a vision for where it goes.
So how does that work in theater? Because I understand.
Great question.
I understand the television part is like, well, this is a platform or a network has to, or a studio puts up the money. They put it, traditionally a studio would pay for something and then they had to deal with a network and then they would take it to a network and then the network would, you know, like sell the ads and monetize it. Everyone would, they would syndicate it. You know, there was a real, like now it's a little more of a circuitous path to monetization, which is a relatively new word. But in theater, how does that work? Hey, someone sees your show, the show kills, and they go, okay, now we got to put it up, and that's going to require X amount of dollars. We're going to run it for 6 weeks, and if it does well, then you,
it's like the pole position.
You get to the next checkpoint, and then you move it up.
Yeah, I don't know all of it because I've not, I mean, I have two shows in development because we're also making Clusterfunk into a musical at the same time. As a Broadway. I mean,
That's a great idea.
Yeah, well, kind of. Hallmark is so similar in terms of tropes to a classic Broadway musical, so it kind of translates really nicely. But that, you know, we have a nice team put together for that too. So in both situations, you kind of try to you partner with people who have money, and you hope that it's like you try to have a strategic plan for, is it a little engine that could show that should open downtown, you know, and just run downtown. I mean, I think this show probably is that. Or is it a show that you, there's a million ways to do it. Do you go to Edinburgh and put it up there? Do you move it? You know, I guess success in the theater is defined by monetary success is you make it to Broadway, you run on Broadway, and then you tour. The money's all in touring.
Okay.
I have no idea like what that would mean for a show like this, but and or licensing. So I'm not sure that this would ever do that. But for me, again, success would just be the opportunity to play it out, live it out a little bit. We have special guest stars, so it would be a fun place to, like, I don't know if you saw Gutenberg on Broadway or you saw, I think it was where guests come in. You know, it'd be fun to have like people like that. But then also we have a lot of content. We've filmed her in a lot of places, this character. So we're also putting, and Charlie says, I'm not allowed to say this anymore, but in this new era, again, like I just don't want to try to sell something to anybody anymore and have, and be disappointed. So I might just try to make it and put it on YouTube and the thing I'm not allowed to say anymore is web series.
You're going to put your web series on the net?
I'm going to put the web series on the net. He was like, stop saying web series. I don't think it's called web series. But I've asked a lot of people and there's no other term. Short form series?
I think it's just a series now because it's, you know, like YouTube is like the largest streamer, you know, like it's not like it was to our Gen X minds like 10 or 12 years ago where it's like, oh, that's cute, a web series. It's like, oh, like you said, well, they're getting more views than most television, if not all television shows.
And again, like everyone's saying, it's like this IP era. Like I would just rather, and I'm not saying it in any kind of like bitter, I mean, I'm a little bitter, but in general, it's more just that I want to be able to make it the way that I want to make it and have fun doing it.
I think touring would be great because it just, again, this feels like a live show experience.
Definitely. And back to that point, so they recorded it and we'd send it to a few producers who I'm waiting to talk to. And again, it's just that awful feeling when you watch something that you've taped, you know, that was such a magical night. And then you're like,
it's really hard to capture that in two dimensions.
It's awful.
You know, because I remember when I was years ago when I shot my last comedy special, there were like VR was a buzzword. So like, oh, we're gonna put a VR camera in the audience.
VR web series.
A VR web series for the net. and it was like, well, not every experience is gonna be great for VR because it still doesn't feel necessarily like you're there. And you're not really watching a show. You're looking around and be like, oh my God, that guy's shoes look so, they're like right there, you know? And so with like a certain type of content, you really need to direct where people are looking so they know what's happening. And but when you're actually, again, it's just putting people, human beings, in a room, in a shared space, there's just no real, you know, until we can just put like wires in our brain that activate those parts of our brain neurologically and fire off those little synapses, there's no replacement for the live show experience, which is why
I don't go to silent raves.
Is that the only reason? I feel like I'd be like 100. Like
that and my aversion to drugs.
That too. Why are you guys wearing headphones? What's the...
You're going to take this off so I can talk.
You're not going to be able to hear me. You're not going to be able to hear me judge you.
I will never get over what that looks like from the outside.
It does look funny, but it probably is pretty great. First of all, it's great for anyone who's near it. So that they are not disturbed. I feel like
that's fair.
It's practical for a lot of reasons. And also, you can control the volume. So it is like a shared, not shared experience. It's an individualistically shared experience.
Have you been to them?
I've seen them. Have I been to them? Honey, after the baby goes to bed.
I was going to say, I'm going to a silent rave.
Yeah, sweetheart, daddy's got to go to a silent rave.
Yeah.
He's got to go in the middle of a field and put on headphones. God.
And VR, and same with VR experiences. I'll never be able to, if somebody saw me like that, to me, that's like the equivalent of showing up at somebody's house with their pants off.
You feel, you're too vulnerable with like a headset on your face.
It's just so stupid looking.
Stumbling around there's a fake chair I got to step over. Whoa.
Air swimming.
Yep.
Yeah. No, that's a no for me. And same with those same with like Facebook glasses.
Yeah.
But you want to know something? I'm blind in my right eye.
Okay.
Legally. I can see a little bit. So my perception, depth perception is like, I don't enjoy a 3D movie. So maybe all of these things that are like that seem very unpleasant.
I don't think I knew that. Is it?
It's from birth. It was astigmatism.
Yeah.
So just, yeah, I was patched a lot as a kid.
Got it.
I think that's why I'm an artist. Because I basically like had to look out of my right eye all the time as a kid. It's like being forced to be left-handed, sort of.
And how does it affect like depth perception? And
it's bad. I mean, not to me, because
right.
It's my eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I'm not very good at, like I never played tennis or anything like that as a kid. I do now, because I figure, who cares? I'm just going to be bad at tennis.
Well, that's the thing that's great about starting stuff later is that you like when you're young, you feel like you have to be the best at it.
Yeah.
And when you're older, you're like, I'm never going to, I don't give a shit. It doesn't matter.
I just want to have some light ladies fitness and friends.
Did you? Light ladies fitness.
Come on. And then have a lemonade after.
Do you still play the violin?
Oh yeah.
Because I remember when I started playing piano, you were like, that's so interesting. You started playing the piano because I just picked up the violin again.
Yeah. I fiddle, but not well, but I love it. You know I love it.
I do.
I go through phases. So I haven't seen you. I think I told you I went to fiddle camp finally.
Finally.
Finally. I've been trying to go to fiddle camp. I'm sure, I feel like I've told you this, but when I turned 50, you know, your family comes to you and they're like, anything you want. You want to go learn to cook in Tuscany? This is a big number, big milestone number. What do you want? And I was like, I want to go to Appalachian fiddle camp,
the whole family.
And they were like, absolutely not. We will not do that.
But it's my...
I know, literally.
You said anything.
Like, I know. They were like, nope, we're not doing that one. I was like, oh, come on. You can do clogging and storytelling jams while I'm...
Well, definitely no now. You should have stopped before.
I know.
Maybe on the fence.
But my daughter, I have to say, like, there are all these earthy, crunchy camps. Like, they have that. They literally, like...
By the way, it sounds awesome.
I know. I'm going to call you next time because... anyway, so then finally last year, it was pretty great. I got on all these mailing lists because I did a couple of virtual fiddle camps during the pandy.
Yeah.
That's when you picked up the piano, right?
That was it was like right before the old pandy I picked it up, but then I really leaned into it because it's so hard to learn an instrument that I couldn't stress about anything else. When I was very anxious, I would just go sit at a piano because it required all my focus.
This is the thing, back to the question about mindfulness, right? It is the most
forces you to be present.
Meditation. It is 100% present. You go into a super happy brain place. It's really hard and really fulfilling. So fiddle to violin. Now, this is where we go viral, Chris. just make sure, guys, that we all watch this part. Fiddle to violin is like rap to Shakespeare.
Okay.
Okay, so it's like, it's a completely different lexicon. It may be the same fundamentals of like holding it, but people who fiddle play very differently than people who studied violin. So I am invested in learning how to improvise, how to combine, because violin was very rigid and very uptight and very perfectionistic, which drove me crazy eventually. So fiddle, to me, I want out of the violin what I have in my life as a singer. Again, I studied as a classical singer.
Your voice is amazing.
Well, thank you. But I then went off, you know, then I went off the reservation, left music school, did improv comedy, did musical theater, which is pretty uptight as well. And then when I started really performing live as a musician, I really just wanted to be able to sing in a way that was like improvisatory and fun and loose and ridiculous, which is how I am, but using the instrument. And that's why I ended up singing jazz as much as I did, and sort of standards and old timey stuff, because it's lyrically driven, it's ridiculous, it's fun, and you can play with it, like you can have a good time. So I wanted to figure out how to do that on the fiddle, and really good fiddlers are like, there's sort of basic, there's a lot of basics to it, but then the rest of it, you're all...
My guitar teacher is a bluegrass guy. I love bluegrass.
Yeah.
Because it is a lot of like,
yeah,
you're doing a lot of runs and a lot, yeah, of it. And it weirdly is this like kind of grassrootsy, very built on specific music theory,
yep,
but really fun. But just you talking about fiddle camp and being present, I was like, oh my God, the $1 billion idea is that you sell.
Oh no.
You sell a meditation camp based around the fiddle, where rich people, and you call it like strings, and it's like rich people in yoga pants, where I think you could get away with it for like a good 2 or 3 years of using the fiddle as like a yoga meditation device, just to
like
see.
Four people would come, but
I bet it would be more.
What's that game show that's so funny, that's the made up, what is that show, it's so brilliant, where they did a fake reality show?
Average Joe.
Yeah,
was that the one where, yeah, like everyone, yeah, was in on it but the one guy?
Yes, it really is one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. And I mean, way back, like all these incredible comedians, like Kristen Wiig was on it, like all these amazing, yeah, comedians back in the day. Anyway, that's what this would be. This would be like, it would have to be like the Average Joe of meditation.
You think it would be like, some people would have to be in on it.
At a certain point.
I think fiddle camp sounds amazing.
Well, there's, again, I'm going to start going all the time now. And there's like ones, I will invite you, because there's a lot of like guitar and bluegrass crossover. So when Dimity gets older, you should come, because it is a hoot and nanny, and it's a bunch of old fucking hippies, you know. There's the one that I'm trying to get. I keep getting a job like right when I think I'm going to be able to go and not be able to go, but it's in Louisiana, and they have like, it's called Black Pot, and they just like nightly jams and like crazy like mandolin players and washboard players, and then they have like gumbo making and sausage making and like all these like.
Maybe for September L. Davis, this is a thing where she feels like. She's realized that she's out of touch.
Yeah.
So she opts to go to fiddle camp, thinking that's going to ground her, but just can't get out of her own.
She would hate it. She would hate it. And because it's too socialist.
Oh, gotcha.
You know, she's like, but I tried, like Fred Armisen and I was like, let's do a travel documentary and just go to a bunch of these and film them.
Oh my God, that's such a great
idea. They're insane, you know?
Fred would love that.
Yeah, but he's always touring. But I mean, it's like a whole subculture. I mean, basically it's like a lot of like, the one that I ended up going to, because it was in Nashville and it was on my birthday, and it's so competitive.
Well, your birthday's May 4th. I know that because it's the
Star Wars.
May the 4th. Sorry, I should have remembered that it was Star Wars Day because of your birthday.
Because of my day.
Unfortunately, it was the...
It's totally fine. And I'm,
May the 4th be with you. Oh, Anna Gasteyer's birthday? Oh, yeah, I was talking about... Oh, you mean the one with the shiny robots? No, I was talking about Anna. I was just talking about Anna's birthday.
And anyway, this fiddle camp was so competitive and hard to get into that you had to sign up at 9 a.m. New Year's Day.
Holy shit.
So, and it was full by 9:07.
Oh my God.
Yep. So we did it. And Charlie was like, I was like, look, it's a sign. It's on May the 4th. We got to go. It's a weekend. So he came, bless his heart. And he really had fun. He did what we always do. We go to parts we are not familiar with. Went to Waffle House. Went to the Range. And went to Boot Barn and bought some clothes.
Fantastic. I don't know what the Range is, other than Bruce Hornsby's backup
band. The Range
is
where you shoot stuff.
Oh, the Range.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was thinking of Mandolin Rain. I was way off on that one.
Yeah, Home on the Range. Yep.
Listen to the mandolin. Yep.
Charlie's a big When and Roamer.
Charlie is such a sweetheart. And I've always loved that you know, whenever I perform in New York, you guys would come to the shows.
Oh,
and I
just so
appreciate
fun.
You so much.
The best.
But I am so appreciative that you came to do this, and
I went on and I love you to pieces too, and I went on and on and on. But you are the OG. You are the cornerstone.
No,
podcast.
There's ORGers that I started at a time, but I was definitely I was also standing on the shoulders of much, you know, better ORGers. And so it's just crazy to me now that I think back, like, 15 years ago, you know, it's like a decade and a half of, you know, and now, you know, like, it's just so funny, like 15 years ago, people were like, what do you want to do a podcast? What is that? I got to come to your mom's basement? And what is it, like a ham radio?
Yeah.
Now those people have podcast networks. You know, it's just like, it's just a different time, you know, but I love that we live in an age where anyone can just pick up a thing and start, you know, being who they are and connecting with people. And, you know, I guess that is the, you know, as much as we've sort of talked about like the negative sides of the silo, it is good that people can kind of have these creative outlets and expressions where they actually can find, you know, whatever sort of community they can, you know, in the digital space. But I really, and we didn't even get to talk about how you're making your son do a podcast at a retirement home, which is such an amazing.
I'm not doing a podcast, but my son.
No,
is going
that you're
to,
that you're making your son do a podcast.
He's going to live with my parents in their old folks' home, and so to fill his days, I was like, yeah, you have to do a podcast. You have to interview old people.
Now, is it sort of like an Elderly Bosom Buddies where he's disguising himself as an elderly person to live there? Does he have to pretend? Does that?
He said he's an old man with progeria.
Yeah, he has to disguise himself to get in.
No, I was a little worried about it. No, he's staying for a whole month because he does altitude training as a runner. So
gotcha.
He's got to stay for like a month. My parents are besides themselves. They're so excited.
Of course they are. It's his great grandparents.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you said, this is what you told me before, is like, well, you got to go around and interview people.
Yep. I was like, this is a, forgive the expression, golden opportunity. Like you have to, you know, he's 17. Like you're surrounded by people in their 80s and 90s. Like, don't you want to glean a little wisdom? And he's curious about it enough. I'm making him do it.
Is he calling it thank you for being a friend, or is there some other... is there some other... I think it's a genius thing to do, because also, what better way to teach a young person how to listen, to teach them empathy, to teach them, like, hey, you know, culturally, a lot of times we just park people in these homes and forget about them.
Yeah.
And you're giving them the opportunity. You're like, you're giving them validation and attention, and because they all have value. They all have value. They all have valuable stories. They've lived incredible lives, probably. They have experience. Like, you can really,
and
it could change his world to talk to
I think
to
it really will. And I think a generation of, you know, highly anxious teenagers, as we've all read on all the studies. And I think to know that there are people who have, I just think talking to people who have lived multiple chapters and survived a lot is a really probably reassuring phenomenon. And he's interested in, you know, in veterans. And I was like, you know, there's some people there, and that my parents live in New Mexico. So some of these guys worked at like Alamo Labs, and, you know, there's some crazy like smarty pants. So he'll talk to some of them. And I don't know. I told my mom she's the talent booker. So I also feel like, you know, people.
Oh my God!
Everybody wants
people
to
in her
seen.
Home. You'd be like, "Can I get on your grandson's podcast? How many followers do you have? Can you market? Can you market this?
Depends.
If we have you on?
Yeah, that's a good point.
He's going to send you some clips. Just send us your social handles. We'll kind of look at your metrics
and see. Yeah, your engagement is high. Your one granddaughter comments a lot. So I mean, I'll let you know. I'll keep you posted. And I'll send it to you when it comes out. I'm designating my daughter, who's 6 years older, as the producer.
Amazing.
Because again, otherwise he's like, what are you going to, I said, because his days, he's going to be there for a month.
This is a brilliant parenting thing to get them to do that. And also just the idea that they're going to create something together that has real meaning.
Hopefully.
It's a great idea.
I'm really excited.
It's a great idea.
And I feel like he's a good kid, you know, so hopefully, I'm sure he's shy, but I was like, we'll do it. Start with grandma and granddad, you know, ask them the questions, and then we'll sort of warm up so that you know what you're doing.
This is a great idea.
I'll send you the final cut.
I can't thank you enough for, I honestly, like, it's, I was so delighted when you texted me, you're like, hey, I'm going to be in LA. You can do the podcast. Like, oh my God. Thank you for asking, because I always hate bugging people.
You asked me, and I told you, I was like, I'm not doing any more podcasts. And then you asked, and I was like, okay, doing Christmas. I like doing Christmas.
This is the last one. As you grab the Indiana Jones hat under, yeah, as the wall is closing, you're just like, I was the hat that you grabbed.
It was the Sentimental Man, the male, gay, wicked podcast 2 weeks ago that I'd promised to do, and now this.
I just, you know, whenever I'm in New York for visiting Lydia's mom, it's like, there are a couple people that you're always someone that I reach out to and be like, hey, we're in New York. Oh, and a lot of times, I think last time you were doing Once Upon a Mattress.
Yep.
So you were on the West Coast. We had swapped coasts.
I know.
And, but I just, you're someone that I always wish, like, fuck, I really want to hang out with her more often, because I feel like we're friends, but I really want to be better friends.
Okay, good. And you can look at me when you say it.
I get shy because it's...
We're friends.
I'm expressing a vulnerability.
We're friends.
I feel like it's weird if I'm like, I feel like we could hang out.
Let's be friends.
Like. I got to say, we really, not only we stick...
Share and comment.
Not only we stick the landing in the end, we really put the flag in the golf course on this one.
We really did. We're going to go to Disneyland. That's our next plan.
You absolutely have to come. We call it the park. We capital P. You actually absolutely have to come to the park with us. Come to Disneyland with us, because it's we will show you every, because you're not as familiar with the Anaheim park.
I love Anaheim.
We will show you OG Disneyland.
Do you go all the time?
We used to go more often. We're going to go in September. Because now Dimity, man, we were really cautious to not overwhelm her,
yeah,
and basically like be stage parents for Disneyland. Yeah. Where it's like, why aren't you? This is our favorite thing. Why isn't it your favorite?
And there's phases, but that's one of the great things about Disneyland is each different chapter works. Because you even go through like the weird button nerd phase.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. My wife collects all the little
times when you go to the shows. Yeah.
Collects the Vinylmation. Yeah, things. Like there's awesome. We got a hotel. You know, we'd get a hotel room. We generally tried to keep her on her like nap meal schedule, yep, so she wasn't thrown off and, yep, overwhelmed, because we didn't know. It's like bringing her around 50,000 people or however many.
It's exhausting, yeah.
So it's like we'd get up, have breakfast, take her into the park for a couple hours, get her back to the hotel, some food, nap, go back out for a couple more hours, so her brains aren't blowing out of the side, yeah, of her head. And we got to meet Mickey, and I almost just burst into tears, because when we met him, it's hard to not get emotional even talking about it. She literally, I'd never seen her do this before. She goes, I was like, this is Mickey. And she goes, oh, hello, Mickey. I'm Dimity. And she was like barely 3 years old. And we were just like,
she wasn't freaked out.
No. She like introduced herself. It was like, you forget that there's the first time that people, yeah, as humans do certain things. It was the first time I had ever seen her introduce herself. But she watched a lot. She's watched a lot of the Disney stuff, a lot of the different Mickey stuff. So she knows the characters. And we went around the corner and Minnie was right there. And then she got to meet Minnie.
Oh my God, that's
so
cute.
And it was just like, she, like, the smile, she was beaming, and we didn't know how it was going to go. Lydia and I were terrified. Yeah. Like, well, she hasn't seen them in three dimensions. It could scare the shit out of her.
Does she do costumes yet?
Some. Yeah, yeah, she does some.
That'll
but
kick in.
Listen, I'm all in, you know, like she puts makeup on me, she does my nails, yeah, she puts shit in my hair, good, like she puts stickers on my eyes, and I'm just a canvas. I'm like, do whatever makes you feel creative. Yeah. And I just absolutely am so thankful that, did you take your kids early on to Disney,
yeah,
World?
All the phases. Cause again, they're 6 years apart. So, yeah, they kind of just got thrown in to the little one especially, but say, just as you're describing, like totally freaked, yeah, different phases. Once really freaked out by characters, then not costumes, not, you know, roller coasters, not shows, not, I mean, that's what the genius of those parks are, is that they're so dimensional that there's, yeah, something for everyone. I mean, you know, being able to see like those LED castle lights. I mean, there's so many different fireworks. Like, everyone's got something that they can be really pumped about, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like we've done like all of them. We've gone from like, I have my autograph book and I got to meet all the print, you know, whatever. So we went through those times where like,
it's hard. And I feel like there's a lot of pressure on parents, especially if you don't live near a park where that's your family vacation.
Oh my God.
You know,
and every minute's like accounted
every
for.
Every minute is accounted for. It costs a lot of money.
So expensive.
It's a lot of like stuff to, you know, to plan. And
no, it's adrenal
I empathize
too.
With the pressures of, oh, my kid's not, because when they're when they're like toddlers, they're just as happy playing in with rocks or in a grocery store as like they don't know the difference. So I can understand why it would be incredibly difficult for like people who really love the experience and are just, it just takes a minute to like get the kid on board.
Yeah.
And so
I've done all of it. I've been crying, early leaving, all of it. But my kids are old. I have a 23-year-old.
My friend said he took his kids when they were like 3 and 5, and they like in downtown Disney, they stopped in like the Lego store or something, and the kids were obsessed with that.
Yeah.
And it's like, but the kids really wanted a Lego set or something, and he was like, but this will still, there's like 20 of these, they'll still be, and the kids fucking flipped out.
Yep.
They took them into the park. The kids were still pissed off about the Lego store. Yep. And at lunchtime, they were like, well, I guess we just go. Because there's no point in torturing them anymore. They want to go to the Lego store. Let's fucking go back to
the... Yeah, and this crazy, like, you know, no, you have to learn your own family's, like...
Well, you have to be careful not to,
shoot
to infuse too much of your... Like, this has to be the greatest experience for you because it is for me. And kind of let them discover it.
Yep.
And then, if you can be a little patient, they will get on board with it. And then you can, you know,
all
like,
the different phases.
Let all the Disney flag fly.
But I'm telling you, that's what I mean. The first time we took Frances was she was a 2. I remember because we had just gone to like a super fancy, super adult wedding in Napa that was like could not be. She was in the wedding, so she was there, but it was just, you know, dinners and wine caves and like, you know, really gustatorial experiences and like with a toddler, you know, and it's just like the whole time you just like are apologizing and feeling bad. And I remember we got to Disney. It was that thing of like, they feed the kid right away. You know, they bring the food to the child. There's like a cup with a straw, with a lid that's like indestructible and just feeling like, oh my God, we're safe here. You know,
if you're ever in a situation like that again for any parents, what you got to do is if you're at a wedding like that, you just got to get a teapot and then just go, be our guest, blah, 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 blah. You got to Disney-fy the like, oh, we're at this, we're at the Beast's castle.
I probably should have done that. It wasn't, I just remember feeling very grateful that it was a world where we were not apologetic for having a kid. Like there's a kid melting down and every 4 square feet at Disney.
Oh, that, yeah.
So,
yes.
You know, you're not like.
And you really do understand.
Yeah.
And also like, it is a lot for a kid to take in.
Yeah.
Like,
it's a lot for me. Like at the end of the day, like you're 30,000 steps, your feet hurt, you're like dizzy. I mean, I get like adrenal from the planning and everything.
The thing that I never predicted about what it would be to be a parent is recognizing, you understand the big ticket items, you know, when they've, when they're hungry, when they're tired, when they've soiled themselves.
Sure. Is that what you say?
I don't know why
house?
I did Frank Nelson.
Yeah. Have you soiled yourself,
yes.
darling?
Yes. Ooh, Mr. Flintstone. Mrs. Ricardo. But I don't know why I went that direction with it. But overstimulation was not anything that I ever realized. Like their tiny brains get packed really easily and you have to recognize that, take a step back, give them quiet time, let them process, let them decompress, because a lot of days of their life are like, it's finals week.
Yeah.
And you're cramming and your brain can't take anymore.
Yeah.
And you don't realize like, they're not being jerks. Their brains are literally full, and this is the only way that they can express that. Give them space to chill the F down.
And years, like whole years are like that. Like 3 is supposedly, when I took child psych, that's like one of the reasons Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was so popular with 3-year-olds, because it's like, after the like, of Sesame Street, then you go, you know, the like delightful manic comedy music whatever for 3-year-olds. Mr. Rogers was like, right,
watching
where
a guy slowly put on a sweater.
Like, can I watch you untie your shoes a couple little
bit
longer?
Put on super those comfortable
soothing.
Shoes.
Yeah, but it's very soothing.
Now let's go look at a hand puppet shaped like a cat.
And that part always bummed me out.
But it bummed.
It bummed me out. What was her name, Madam?
Lady.
Name? Lady Fairchild.
Fairchild. And King something. And
I think I instinctively knew.
Meow meow. Was it Meow Meow Kitty or?
Meow, meow, kitty, meow, meow.
Meow, 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 meow. Boo Boo Kitty. This is going to get so fucking Gen X-y. Because I think Boo Boo Kitty was Laverne and Shirley.
Oh my God.
Meow, meow. Maybe it was Meow Meow Kitty. Meow, 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 meow,
kitty, meow, meow, meow.
Meow, meow, meow.
I think I instinctively understood that I was dangerously close to being cast as Lady Fairchild early in my career. That's my I always understood that. Like, I was always like, okay, that's an old fart. I don't want to play that part.
You don't want to play that
no.
part.
No. But I've always been playing. I mean, you know, there's an old joke in musical theater people are you a Maria or a Mother Superior? Usually character actresses are Mother Superior.
Is that a
well
sound
before
of music?
Their time. Yes.
Reference bank?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
It's like the old matronly. There's always that girl that plays a lot of those parts.
Oh, gotcha.
And I kind of like walked in between the two.
Well, hopefully I will get to see you. We should hang out on purpose without microphones.
I would love it.
How long are you going to be in the City of Angels?
Leaving tomorrow at 6 a.m.
God damn it.
That's why I'm going to
the pack. Let's just talk all the way through. I'll talk you through to the airport.
TSA. Yeah. I have to go home and pack and pretend that I have to go be organized.
Please give your husband a big hug for me. And
I love that we're both holding microphones for this conversation.
the part where...
The friendship part.
Two performers that just can't not be somehow like... Hey, I think you did a really good job, and I just want to say I really appreciate
really
your
friendship. You're a good interviewer, so your friendship is good,
no,
too.
No, I appreciate that, too, and I just think it's really nice that nice we have these intimate moments together. You're getting this
incredibly
all
natural.
Good, because this is
sitting
very
in profile.
I just want to make sure we get these authentic moments, because they get a lot of engagement.
With your two authentic sofas.
Yep, this really nailed my style. Black pleather.
Let's get two black pleathers in a V.
Yeah. Mm. You know, we could key out these and just put any... We could just be sitting...
Will you put me in an old-timey throne?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'd love it.
Yep. As Lady Fairchild.
Thank you.
Meow, meow, meow. Meow, meow, meow.